with you and eager to study with us, and encourage you to put a marker at least. We'll come eventually to Romans, the 14th chapter, where we're going to be making our study this evening. Romans chapter 14. We're in the midst of a series on fellowship that, as you know, I'm preparing to get ready for a lecture program in Oklahoma on fellowship. And this is the third of the five lessons that I'm preparing for that. Talk about the importance of fellowship. We've looked at this each time, and I want to remind you of the importance of fellowship, why fellowship is so important. You may say that I'm more interested in something practical. This is practical to us, because fellowship is something we all have to deal with. 3 John demonstrates this principle that we have no right to refuse fellowship to someone whom God wants us to fellowship. Diotrephes was condemned for that. On the other hand, 2 John demonstrates to us that we cannot extend fellowship to those that we should not have fellowship. God condemned some for that. So it is important to know how to determine whom we fellowship, and that we're fellowshipping right people, and that those we should not fellowship, we're not having fellowship with. And so where do we make those decisions? Well, we may have to make those as a congregation. What preachers we're going to support? We can't have fellowship with this one because he teaches error. Or we can't fellowship someone else because they're practicing sin. Or it may be a preacher that we want to schedule for a meeting that we can't fellowship him. We can't have him preaching in our pulpit for the simple reason he may be that he's taught some error. And so we can't have fellowship based on 2 John in verse 9. Or you may decide to move somewhere and you place membership with the congregation. Come to find out maybe there's some error being tolerated within the congregation. The preacher holds an erroneous view on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And can you fellowship that? Can you be in fellowship? Those are questions that you'll have to answer. And so that's why the subject is so important. Let me remind you where we've been. We've talked about what biblical fellowship is in our first lesson. And our conclusion from 2 Corinthians 6 is that fellowship involves an agreement in principle that leads to joint or common action in spiritual work. That led us to our second study where we talked about fellowship in the truth. And what we learned there was that truth is the basis for unity. Truth is the basis for fellowship. Truth is the basis for rejecting people, and truth is something that includes the whole revelation of God, not just part of the revelation. And our conclusion was that unity and fellowship is dear and precious, but it should not be maintained at the expense of the truth. Truth is the basis for fellowship. Let's talk about Romans 14. In this passage says, receive him. In the next study, we're going to look at 2 John, where someone is to be rejected. Here, somebody is to be embraced and received. Who is to be embraced and to be received? That's the question at hand in Romans 14. And we'll talk about that and explain all of that in just a moment. But in the midst of questions and controversy, fellowship is always raised. In the history of the church, when there has been division over some question, every time that division came and the controversy arose, whether it be back in the 1800s or in the 1900s or whatever, just recently, when that controversy arises among brethren, Romans 14 comes to play, because somebody will raise the question, can we have fellowship in spite of our differences? So the question is, does Romans 14 apply to this particular issue, whatever that issue may be? Well, that question came up when the instrument of music question in 1849, and 1849, the Missionary Society, when premillennialism was a question in the 1930s, the question of Romans 14 came to play. The same thing with institutionalism, the same thing with the social gospel, and more recently the divorce and remarriage controversy. That every time those questions are raised, and there'll be another one in a few years, and then another one a few years after that, then there'll be another controversy, because that's the history of the church. So when a controversy arises, and some of these will be repeated, there's going to be a question of fellowship and whether or not Romans 14 applies to that. So let's start by looking at Romans 14 and open your Bible there. And let's first of all talk about the context. We're in Romans 14, 6. Let's talk about the context of the book. There are three major sections of the book of Romans. He's talking about justification by faith, apart from the law, in the first 8 chapters. The chapters 9 through 11, the middle section, is a parenthetical section that talks about God rejecting the Jews and accepting the Gentiles. But where our chapter 6 is in the section that deals with relationships, the Christian and his relationships. His relationship to God, his relationship to fellow Christians, his relationship to his enemy, his relationship to the world, and his relationship to civil government, chapter 13, and now to this brother with a weak conscience in chapter 14. So it's dealing with relationships. Now, specifically in that section on relationships, he deals with God, Christians, and all men, civil government. But this chapter, in chapters 14 and 15, he talks about the brother who is a weak brother, not weak in his faith, but it has to do with a weak conscience. We'll define that in just a moment. That's the context in which it says. Let us talk about the weak brother. Notice in verse 1 of Romans chapter 14, it says, "Receive one who is weak in the faith." Let's talk about the nature of this brother's weakness. Someone is described as being weak and someone is described as being strong. What is the nature of this weak brother? In this context, it is not weak in faith in God. In fact, he has very strong faith in God, as we're going to see as we work through the context. It is not that he's weak in service to the Lord. In fact, it's because of his service to the Lord that he either eats or does not eat the meat that he has, which is in the context of the subject of Romans chapter 14. He is not weak in spiritual strength. That is not the subject matter in Romans chapter 14. The weakness that is involved is a weakness in his conscience. I want you to notice verse 1. Verse 1 says, "Receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things." Now, what is meant by doubtful things? Well, the American Standard translates that scruples. The Revised Standard says, and the New American Standard, and the English Standard says, opinion. So he's talking about his personal opinion. Now we'll see that more when we talk about the matter of the context a little bit later. We'll see that in a little more detail in the context of Romans chapter 14. But the matters of its personal opinion, it's a matter of Christian liberty that he's talking about in the context. So the weak brother is one who has a weak conscience. Now let's get ahead of ourselves to talk about the matter of eating of meats. That's one of the subjects that is in the context. Nothing wrong with eating meat. But there are some who had the concept they could not conscientiously eat that meat. So consequently, that bothers their conscience. It's contrary to their scruples. It's contrary to their opinion. So consequently, they're weak in their conscience. Their conscience will not allow that. That's the nature of the weakness of the brother. Now, there are two issues that are raised in Romans chapter 14. The two issues are the matter of eating of meats, verse 3, verse 2, 3, and 4, and the observing of days, verse 5. Those were the two questions at hand. What did the matter of eating of meats involve, and why was that a question? This had to do with the period of time when the church was being integrated and bringing two races, Jews and Gentiles, together, Ephesians 2, into one. One in Christ. Meshing those two backgrounds together caused some difficulties, and there were some problems, and this was one of them. For the Jew could very well still be bothered by the Old Testament restrictions and regulations concerning meat. What do we mean by that? Well, they viewed some of the meat based upon Old Testament regulations as being clean or unclean. For example, the Jew could not eat pork, but under New Testament regulation, he could do that. So that which had been unclean is suddenly now clean. And now he's allowed to eat that. So he's invited to a meal somewhere and sits down with someone who serves him pork. And it may be that his conscience won't allow him to eat that because he has for years been taught you not to eat that. And I know that God said it's okay, but I just can't bring myself to do that. It bothers my conscience. So for the Jew, the eating of meat is still bothered by Old Testament restrictions and regulations. For the Gentile, they very well may have still associated it with the sacrifice to idols. Quite often a sacrifice would be made to an idol, and then there would be a feast in honor of the idol, and you would eat the meat that had been sacrificed, but you ate it in honor of the idol. So the eating of meat was always in honor of some idol in the mind of the Gentile, so he can't eat the meat now that he's been converted to the Lord because he says, that reminds me of my idolatry. I can't do that. So for various reasons, one might not be able to eat meat. That was one of the issues. Then there is the observing of days, according to verse 5. We're going to come back to that in verse 5 in just a moment. What was the question or the issue concerning the observing of days? Well, Melvin Curry made this observation about Romans chapter 14. He said, Paul never tolerated the binding of Jewish holidays on Gentile Christians, Colossians 2, Galatians 4. However, he permitted the observance of such practices by Jewish Christians so long as they did not bind them on others. Some Jewish Christians could not bring themselves to abandon the observance of the Sabbath, the holy days after they were baptized into Christ. Not to rest on the Sabbath would have been a violation of their conscience. Well, you can see how that if you were a Jew who had been converted and you had always rested on the Sabbath, that suddenly now things have changed, that you can work on the Sabbath day because it's no longer binding upon you. And so someone asks you to work, someone asks you to engage in something, you say, no, I've always rested on the Sabbath and I can't bring my conscience to do that. So you can see why one would might observe a certain day. Let's talk about the care and the love for this brother that is to be shown. That's in the context. We're still describing the overall context. And what I want you to see is that Romans chapter 13, verses 8 through 10, talk about love. Let's back up just a little bit. In verses 8 through 10, it says, owe no man anything but to love. Here is a debt of love that we owe to our brethren. In fact, to the world. He goes further to tell us that love is the fulfilling of the law, verse 10. So he describes love and how we're to love one another. And then in chapter 14, he talks about receiving the brother is driven out of this fact of the love of chapter 13. And that is, we care for his soul and we care about his conscience. So therefore, we are to receive him and accept him. Listen to Brother Lee. He said, would you like to imbibe the wonderful spirit encouraged in chapter 14 of Romans? Then concentrate on learning the meaning of Romans 13, 8 through 10. This passage prepares one for the message of the chapter. So when I get to chapter 13 and I have feasted upon this principle of love and I put it to practice in my life, now I'm ready to practice what chapter 14 talks about. It's talking about showing love and concern and consideration for one who has a weak conscience. Now let's talk about the point of chapter 14. What is the point of Romans chapter 14? The point of chapter 14 is to continue in fellowship in spite of differences. Now that's where Romans 14 comes to play amongst the controversy. We all agree, everyone agrees, that Romans 14 is saying we can continue in fellowship in spite of our differences. Now we'll talk about the nature of those differences in a moment, but notice in verse 1, Romans 14 in verse 1, receive one who is weak in the faith. So we are to receive him. Look at verse 1, he says, do not receive him to dispute. In other words, don't accept him into fellowship, so that you can argue with him and contend with him. There doesn't need to be an argument over this, whatever the issue is. Thirdly, you are to pursue things that make for peace. Rather than there being friction and fighting against one another, it's to be a matter of peace. Let us pursue things which make for peace, verse 19. And then finally, verse 22 is simply saying, if I might paraphrase, don't bind your opinion on others. Whatever is under consideration, I'm not to bind it upon others. Look at verse 22. Do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God. Keep your opinion to yourself. Don't bind it on others. So if you think you can't eat meat, don't bind that on other people. Just don't eat it. Do you think you can? Then eat it, but don't bind it on others if they have to eat meat. Same thing with not observing the resting on the Sabbath. So the point is, continue in fellowship in spite of the differences. Now that's why this passage comes to play in the midst of controversy. Does that apply to doctrinal matters? Does it apply to moral matters? Does it apply to matters of faith? That's the question that has to be answered. Now let's open our Bibles to the 14th chapter. If you're not there, let's work our way through the chapter. We're not going to give detailed comments. I just want to kind of make a quick run through the chapter to get the gist of the message of chapter 14. So open your Bible and let's do a quick exegesis of that chapter 14. Chapter 14 deals with our relationship to this weak brother. We've already set the context. It deals with the relationship to the weak brother. Two major thoughts of the chapter. Verses 1 through 12 says we are to receive the weak brother. Verses 13 to 23 says don't put a stumbling block in your brother's way. So let's talk about receiving the brother. Verse 1, he said receive one who is weak in the faith. And we've already defined that as being weak in his conscience. But not to dispute over doubtful things. So, do not dispute over doubtful things. Not to have disputes over that. So, this is not to be a running argument and a contention when you accept the brother who is weak in his conscience. Now, verses 2 to 4, he says, here's an example of what I'm talking about. And that is that one who is weak cannot eat all things. He said, for one believes that he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. Here's the nature of his weakness. He doesn't believe he can eat meats. He cannot conscientiously do that. Verse 3, let not him who eats despise him who does not eat. Don't look down upon him. And let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has received him. God accepts both of them whether you eat or not. Or who are you to judge another servant? His own master stands before all, indeed he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. He stands before God with reference to that. Now verse 5. Here is another issue that illustrates the point. There is the weak person, that is, he's weak in his conscience, who observes a special day. One person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. But here is one who is a new Jewish convert to Christianity, and he says, you know what, I still can't work on the Sabbath, and I'm just not going to do it. Okay, then just don't work. But here is one who says, I fully understand that the Sabbath doesn't mean anything anymore, so I'm going to work on the Sabbath. Okay, let him do it. Neither one has sinned. That's his point. So accept the one who has a weak conscience with reference to that, not to dispute with him, but accept him. Now, verses 6 through 12 says that each man is functioning in a sense that he's accountable before the Lord. Let's notice what he says. In the matter of days, in the matter of eating, he is functioning before the Lord. He who observes a day observes it to the Lord. Now the one who sets aside this particular day and says, I'm going to keep this day as a special day. Why is he doing that? He's doing it because he's got the Lord in view. And he who does not observe the day, to the Lord he does not observe the day. Why is he working on the Sabbath now under the dispensation of Christ? It's with the Lord in view because the Lord's told him it's all right. They're both doing it with the Lord in view. He who eats to the Lord and gives thanks, and he who does not eat to the Lord, he does not eat and gives thanks. In other words, they both are doing it in view of the fact that they have a relationship with God. It's because of their relationship with God while they abstain or they eat, or they observe the day or they don't. The second element to notice is that no one lives or dies to himself. This verse is misquoted many times or misapplied many times. It is not dealing with our relationship to one another, but our relationship to God in the immediate context. I know the chapter deals with our relationship to one another, but verses 7 and 8 and 9 deal with our relationship to God. Here's what he says. He says, for none of us lives to himself, and no one dies to himself. That's how I know it's dealing with our relationship to God. Furthermore, verse 8, for if we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. His point is that each one is accountable to the Lord. They're doing this with reference to their relationship to the Lord. That's his point in 7 and 8. Now verses 9 through 12, his point is, God, Christ, is Lord over all, and we all give an account to him. Notice it, verse 9. For to this end Christ died and rose and lived again, that he might be the Lord both of the living and of the dead. I'm going to drop down to verse 12 in interest of time, so then each of us will give an account of himself to God. So the brother who eats meats, he's going to give an account of himself to God. And the brother who abstains, he gives an account of himself to God. So what's the point? The point is, receive the weak brother, not to dispute, not have arguments. The kinds of questions are like the eating of meats, the observing of days, and each one then is accountable to the Lord. Now, the second section of the chapter, but before we do that, I want to remind you three things I just noticed in that. That is, it tells me how I'm to receive the weak brother. It tells me who I'm to receive and why I'm to receive him. But it's, how do I receive him? You don't receive him so you can have arguments with him. You don't receive him and embrace him so you can dispute with him. You embrace him and accept him and acknowledge that there is a difference. And you're going to agree to disagree over that. Now, who am I to receive? One who is like the eating of meats, or the one who observes a special day? Now, why do I do that? Because they're doing that in their relationship to the Lord. Now, let's talk about the second section. The point of 13 to the end of the chapter, verses 13 to 23. Is do not put a stumbling block in your brother's way. How so? Well, we'll work our way through that. Look at verse 13. He said, therefore, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or cause to fall in our brother's way. How could you do that? Well, this brother who thinks he conscientiously cannot eat meats, don't invite him to your house for a steak. Just don't do that. Don't have him over for a cookout and cook him a hamburger. Don't do that. Don't serve him pork when he feels like he can't eat pork. I'm putting a stumbling block in his way, giving him an occasion wherein he might violate his conscience, which verse 23 is going to tell me is a sin. Now, why is that important? Well, because nothing is unclean of itself. Notice verse 14. But I am convinced by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean of itself. That is, there's nothing unclean in eating of the meats. It's right within itself to eat meats, and it's right to abstain from meats. That's why I'm about to put a stumbling block in my brother's way. Verse 15, don't destroy your brother with meat. Now, this is interesting because he said if your brother is grieved because of your food. It doesn't mean if he just dislikes what you do that you're to abstain from that. But I'm not to put a stumbling block in his way. In other words, if I eat meats and I feel like I can, I'm going to eat meats. Nothing wrong with that. But I want to eat in your presence. Or invite you to eat meat with me because that may violate your conscience. And so what am I doing at verse 15? I am not to, if you are offended by that, I'm not to destroy you and cause you to violate your conscience over my liberty. But notice verse 16, therefore do not let your good be evil spoken of, your liberty be spoken of, evil spoken of. You have a liberty to eat meats, but you don't have to eat meats. So don't let that liberty become an occasion for your brother to sin and cause your brother to stumble. So it's talking about having fellowship in spite of those differences. Now in verse 19 says, we're to follow after things which make for peace. Therefore let us pursue things which make for peace, whereby we may edify one another. Look for the peaceful course. You have someone who observes a particular day. You have someone that doesn't eat meat, someone else that eats meat. Can we have a peaceful course here that where we can have harmony and peace with one another? Someone says, well, I've got a right to eat meat, and I like to have a grilled steak, and that's who I'll invite the whole congregation over for steaks. Well, we're just going to have to quit doing that. Because, at least inviting everybody. For the simple reason, if somebody's offended, they don't need to be invited to that. You have a right to eat your meat. But the point here is, pursue the peaceful course because you're interested in the soul of your brother. Remember the love? Back in chapter 13, that comes to play. Verse 22. He says, do you have faith? Have it to yourself and before God. That is, keep that opinion, that scruple to yourself. Don't bind it on others. Not saying you can't share, here's what my opinion is. But don't bind it on others. That you have to live by my conscience. You can't eat meat either. Or because I can, you have to eat meat. There's nothing wrong with it, so just go ahead and eat. And then verse 23, that he who doubts is condemned if he eats. What does that mean? If he violates his conscience, it's a sin. So is it ever a sin to eat meat? Well, the text says it's not wrong to eat meat. But it can be. If it violates your conscience, it's wrong to eat meat. And that's true of anything. If it violates your conscience, that's the point, that whatever is not of faith, the faith in this passage, back in verse 1, verse 23, the chapter's bookend with two statements about faith that have reference to opinions or scruples. If it's contrary to your opinion, if it's contrary to your conscience, it's wrong for you to do that. And so that's the point of chapter 23, through verse 23 of chapter 14. That we are to receive the weak brother. Now, I know that's a quick look at that, but I wanted you to see the overall context. You're to receive the weak brother, and you're not to put a stumbling block in your brother's way. Let's talk about the abuse of the chapter, because this is the heart of really what this study is about. How has this chapter been abused? Well, I want to suggest to you that some have applied it to matters of faith and of doctrine and of morals. And that list is long. I won't bore you with all of those quotations. But starting back in the day of instrumental music, question in the church back in the 1800s, when that question was raised, there were those, and some of you have the McGarvey Pendleton commentary on Galatians and Romans, etc. Pendleton, McGarvey, by the way, was soft on instrumental music, and Pendleton argued that Romans 14 fit that question. So he put in that commentary that many of you have, he talks about Romans 14 applying to the instrumental music question. So he put a matter of doctrine and faith right in the middle of Romans chapter 14. Others have put similar questions all through the years, but more recently, when the divorce and remarriage controversy came up, back in the mid-1980s, Brother Ed Harrell wrote a series of 17 articles. Now, the reason I mention Ed Harrell, from about 1989 on, when controversies arise on any question, the responsibility of the division will be laid at his feet because he did more damage than probably any single man in the last 50 years over this question of fellowship. Then I wrote 17 articles on fellowship, trying to defend that we could fellowship someone who taught error on divorce and remarriage, and here's what he said. This is just one of many statements. He said, it is obvious that Christians sometimes disagree about scriptural instructions, even in matters of considerable moral and doctrinal import. That behavior, uniformly practiced throughout the history of Christianity, is, I believe, the issue addressed in Romans 14. The matters of morals and doctrine fit there. Now, what do you think about that? Morals and doctrine. What we just saw is we're to agree to disagree and we're not to dispute. Don't bind it on someone else. So we don't bind morals and we don't bind doctrine. And we're going to agree to disagree with morals and doctrine. That's what he said. Well, he wasn't the only one. Bob Orr, in 1993, said in a sermon, he said, and this was one of many times he said this. I've heard him personally talk to him and confronted him, as well as Ed Harrell, with reference to those quotations. He said, the brethren who say that the principle of Romans 14, 1 Corinthians 8 and 10 can only be applied to matters of indifference have effectively eliminated this passage from any application within our brotherhood. that if it deals with things that are indifferent toward God, that is, God doesn't care one way, then there is no application. It deals with matters of faith and doctrine. Here's the heart of what I want us to talk about. Let's see that Romans 14 deals with matters of liberty and indifference. If you have your Bible and don't have these points marked, I would encourage you to mark these points that I'm about to list. And the question is this passage dealing with doctrine, faith, and morals, or matters of indifference and liberty? Now, by indifference, I'm not saying it's indifferent to the one who holds that view. But when we talk about matters of indifference, it's indifference with reference to God. God doesn't care one way or the other. Now, the brother who cannot conscientiously meet, he's not indifferent about that. He has strong feelings about that. But what does God think about it? God doesn't care. God's indifferent. God doesn't care whether you eat meat or you don't eat meat. So the indifference is with reference to God's view of that. So is this question in Romans 14 a matter of doctrine, faith, and morals, or is it a matter of indifference and personal liberty that you have, Christian liberty that you have? Well, let's see. We're going to see that it has to do with indifference and liberty. Well, in verse 3, you might underline that God has received him. The man under consideration that we are to embrace is one whom God has received. Now, has God received the one who is involved in moral questions? By moral questions, what if he's involved in adultery? Has God received him? Good question, isn't it? What about the man who is a false teacher and teaches error? Has God received him? Look at verse 6. Whatever he's doing, whether he's eating or not eating, he does it to the Lord, for the Lord in you. If one is in an unscriptural marriage, one has a divorce and remarriage contrary to the will of God, is he doing that with the Lord in view? Is it to the Lord? Do you commit adultery to the Lord? When you practice something unscripturally, are you doing it to the Lord? Verse 13, you're not to judge or condemn him. The weak brother is not to condemn the strong, and the strong is not to condemn the weak. Don't be condemning and arguing with one another. Does that involve fornication, adultery, morals, stealing, gambling? One brother published a list of 100 issues that would fit in Romans 14, among which were girly magazines, pornographic magazines would fit there. Really? God, don't condemn him for that? Don't judge him for that? Interesting. Some have put homosexuality in Romans 14. Really? Don't condemn him. Look at verse 14. The point is, it's not wrong within itself. Whatever is under consideration is not wrong within itself. Nothing is unclean of itself. And last of all, look at verse 22. You keep it to yourself and before God. Don't bind that on someone else. Now, if you don't have those marked in the margin of your text, that would be very helpful. If someone raises Romans 14, that, well, we ought to agree to disagree over matters of morals and doctrine, because after all, that's what Romans 14 is about. You remind them that these points tell us that it's a matter of indifference or personal liberty. There's real problems with putting morals and doctrine and faith in Romans 14, as we're going to see. I want you to notice two patterns here. There's a difference in Romans 14 in passages that deal with doctrinal matters. There are different patterns throughout the New Testament. There's some for an individual, some for a church. And we need not confuse the two. There's a plan of redemption for the alien sinner and one for the erring child of God. They differ. We don't need to mix those. When God has instructions for doctrinal matters and one for Romans 14 that's different from that, we need not confuse the two. Let's see what the difference is. In Romans 14, God has received the man who does whatever on either side of that question. But in doctrinal matters, we'll notice in next week's study, God rejects him. He no longer has fellowship with God. The one who goes outside the realm of the doctrine of Christ has not God. God rejected him. That's a big difference. In Romans 14, he does this to the Lord, but the Lord doesn't receive him in doctrinal matters. 2 John 9-11. In verse 13, we're not to judge or condemn him, but in doctrinal matters, we're to mark and denote that brother. Mark those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine. Verse 14 shows that this was not wrong within itself, but this involves sin, 2 John 9. It is a transgression of going outside the realm of the doctrine of Christ. We're to keep this to ourselves, not bind it on others. Jude 3 says we're to contend for the faith. Those are two different patterns. So we're not to take doctrinal matters and insert those into Romans chapter 14. they don't fit in Romans chapter 14. Now let's go back to the context of Romans 14. It might be interesting to mark or make a note of this in the margin of your text. But in this context of Romans 14, there were morals dealt with previously, and there's doctrine dealt with afterwards. And in both cases, on both occasions, both before and after, those were condemned. For example, in Romans chapter 13, verses 12 to 14, just immediately before our chapter, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as on the day, not in revelry and drunkenness and licentiousness, lewdness, not in strife. And even those are moral issues. And what's said about morals? God condemned that and did not approve of that. Well, let's go over to chapter 16 now, and we see doctrinal matters are dealt with. Mark those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine and avoid them. So morals were condemned before. Doctrine was condemned afterwards. That is, morals that were contrary to God's law. Doctrine contrary to God's law. So my question is, how could Romans 14 approve of fellowship with moral and doctrinal issues, disagreeing over those, when morals and doctrine are condemned within the context of the book of Romans? Now, let's talk about the test of what fits in Romans chapter 14. How do I know what fits there? And what kind of test has to be performed? Well, first of all, it must not be something either required or forbidden. Why do I say that? Well, if it is something God requires, then it is not, God is not indifferent toward that, because God expects you to do that. So baptism wouldn't fit there because God requires it. Lord's Supper doesn't fit there because the Lord requires it. So it is something that God is indifferent about. Nor can it be something forbidden, like adultery or gambling or drinking or whatever, because God has forbidden that. So anything God has forbidden or anything God has commanded doesn't fit in Romans chapter 14. So when someone says, I believe the Bible to require this as a matter of law that I put it in Romans 14, you can't have it both ways. But Romans 14 is not talking about things that are forbidden and things that are that demanded of God. Secondly, a liberty must first be authorized. Something is not expedient until first it is lawful. All things are lawful, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful, not be brought under the power of any. The point is, before a thing can be expedient, something we can do of liberty, then it first must be authorized. So here is the church that's going to support a missionary society. Before I can say that fits in Romans 14, it needs to be authorized. If it's not authorized, if it's not in harmony with the authority of the Scriptures, it doesn't fit in Romans 14. Because it's not an expedient unless it's first of all authorized. Thirdly, if one matter of morals and one matter of faith and one matter of doctrine fits there, why not all? That's an important question. You might make that in the margin of your text when someone talks about Romans 14. And they say, well, you know, I think matters of morals fit there. If one matter of moral fits there, then all matters. Say, I think adultery fits there. Like in a divorce and remarriage case, okay, then homosexuality fits there. Why not? And murder fits there. Why not? And drunkenness fits there. Why not? You say, well, I don't think any... Well, why not? Why doesn't it include that? If one matter of doctrine fits there, then other matters of doctrine fit there. If one fits there, why not all? Let's do a little test here. Let's substitute whatever the issue may be for meat. More recently, it's divorce and remarriage controversy, which involves adultery. And let's see if that fits in Romans 14. Let's substitute. Look at verse 3. Does God receive the one who commits adultery? Verse 3. Is that what he's talking about in this context? So no matter whether you marry or don't marry, or you remarry contrary to the will of God, or you do marry in harmony with the will of God, it really doesn't matter. God receives both. But God receives both. That's not going to fit, does it? Can one, you fill in the blank, to the Lord? Can one commit adultery to the Lord? Can one divorce and remarry contrary to the Scriptures, and he's doing so to the Lord? Can you say it's clean within itself? Verse 14. Is it sinful to condemn one who commits adultery? Verse 13. Does God allow one to participate in adultery, or whatever the question may be, as long as he doesn't put a stumbling block in front of others? Don't bind that on me, but you just go ahead with your adultery, but don't cause me to do that. As long as you don't put a stumbling block, then it's all right to do that. Is it good? Verse 16. And you know the answer to that. If Romans 14 includes matters of faith, then we need to know if it includes all matters of faith, all matters of morals, and all matters of doctrine. Secondly, if not, And I haven't met anybody yet among brethren who wants to put all matters of doctrine, faith, and morals there. They just want to put some. Then the question comes, we need to know which matters of faith fit and which do not. And furthermore, we will know the criteria. How did you determine that? No matters of faith fit there. No matters of doctrine fit there. And no matters of doctrine fit there. But when I say, well, I think some matters of faith fit there and some matters of doctrine, how did I determine which ones fit there and which ones don't? Which matters of morals fit there and which ones don't? That's the question that hasn't been yet answered. I want to talk about the dangers of the abuse. And you say, you may look at this and you say, I know this is a controversial chapter and I don't really see the big deal about that. What's the big deal about the abuse of Romans 14? I want you to listen carefully to this, because this affects the future. Affects your children and your grandchildren and the churches where they'll worship. The abuse of Romans 14 is the dump truck into which error is being dumped and trucked off and sold to the brethren. In other words, what it does is it gives an opportunity to hide the proclaimer of error. Let's take divorce and remarriage. When Brother Hedy came out with his erroneous view on divorce and remarriage, brethren begin to cry, Romans 14, Romans 14, Romans 14 applies. In other words, leave him alone, don't condemn him, don't bash his teaching, let him do what he wants to do, and let's all fellowship him, because we need to fellowship in spite of our differences. You know what that allowed? That allowed Brother Haley to come along and throw his error down into that abuse, and that error was trucked off and it was sold to the brethren. You know what that means? That means that the next fellow who comes along says, you know what, if divorce and remarriage fits there, then I think this error fits there. And so that allows for another error to be trucked off and sold to the brethren. And if he can do that, then another one comes along and he says, you know what, if divorce and remarriage and premillennialism fit there, then here's another error that I want you to allow my friend to keep teaching that and don't condemn him. Have him for me. He's supportive. And he loads that up in the dump truck and it's sold to the brethren. Now, not only applies to matters of doctrine, but if you can load that truck up with doctrine, you can load it up with sin. Remember, morals fit there. And if you can put one matter of morals there, like adultery, already, listen carefully, already there have been some putting homosexuality in Romans 14. And what that means is, they're coming along and saying, if you can put adultery there, see what we can do, we can throw this sin into that abuse of Romans 14, and they truck that off and it's sold to the brethren. Already some brethren are questioning. In some circles, is there really anything wrong? Is it a matter of nature? Is there really anything wrong with homosexuality? That's already being asked. It's been trucked off and it's been sold to the brethren. Now keep in mind this principle. The next generation is going to make a logical application of the principle. When you say morals and doctrine and faith fit into Romans 14, and you say, but I don't want to put all of them there, your children are going to put them all there. They're going to go a step further. And they'll make the logical application. I want to suggest to you that loose thinking on Romans 14 leads to three things. To broader gray areas. When we can throw a bunch of things in Romans 14, then everything becomes gray. So it's hard to nail anything down. We talked about that in our previous study. Secondly, it leads to fellowship with various errors. Not just divorce and remarriage, but a number of errors. And that leads, thirdly, to softer preaching. How so? Well, if we're to be tolerant of one who teaches error on this question, we need to be tolerant of that one who teaches error, and then that one who teaches error, and this one over here that teaches error. So we're really not condemning anybody's teaching. And if we're a little soft on morals here, we need to be soft on morals there and morals somewhere else. And so we're not teaching against those. That's softer preaching. And that's already happened in churches across the land. One last thing, and the lesson is yours. Let's talk about how we make application of the text. We know how it's abused. Then what use is this text to us? What kinds of things fit in Romans chapter 14? Let's talk about the criteria. What's the criteria for it fitting there? First of all, Romans 14 in verse 14, nothing is unclean of itself, meaning God is indifferent toward that. So it has to be a matter of indifference where God doesn't care one way or the other. And again, if it's something commanded, God does care. If it is forbidden, God does care. So it has to be something that is a matter of indifference. Eating of meats, God doesn't care either way. Observing of this day, God didn't care either way. You can rest on the Sabbath in the New Testament times, or you can not rest on the Sabbath in New Testament times. Doesn't matter. God doesn't care. Secondly, it's still yet a matter of conscience. Verse 1, it's a matter of disputes, doubtful disputes. It's a matter of conscience or scruples or opinion. Verse 23, whatsoever is not of faith is sin, talking about his conscience. So what kinds of things would fit there? Well, circumcision would fit there.
There are some who think maybe you should circumcise. And they might ask almost as a devotion to the Old Testament concept. Others say, no, we don't do that. Circumcision, God didn't care whether you do that or not. We see that in Galatians and in Romans. Or maybe like the non-religious observance of Christmas. There are some Christians who have a very conscientious problem about that.
They cannot receive a Christmas card. They wouldn't give a Christmas card. They can't put up a tree. And they can't tell people Merry Christmas because they associate it with Catholicism. All right, you don't have to do that.
But that's the one thing that God doesn't care one way or the other. Same thing with playing of cards, with playing of dice. There are Christians who think that that's somehow associated with gambling, and so they couldn't conscientiously do that.
They wouldn't roll a dice in a kid's game for nothing. They think it's wrong.
We don't have to roll dice. You don't have to play cards.
God doesn't care one way or the other.
Or maybe eating at a restaurant where they might have a bar at the end. Or some think that movies, all movies are wrong. You can't go to a movie house because of some bad things that are shown. You can't go to any movie.
And all right, you don't have to go. And so it has to do with matters of indifference where God doesn't care. God doesn't care one way or the other. And it's a matter of conscience.
So how do we apply the passage? Well, let's just take this matter of playing cards. Since there are people who think it's wrong to play cards, then there's nothing wrong with me playing cards if I want to.
There's nothing wrong with me inviting several in my home and playing cards,
as long as they don't have a conscience problem.
But suppose we have somebody that just conscientiously cannot do that. Are we going to invite them to our card game?
No. What if they're at my house while they're eating? Do I ask them, do you want to play cards?
No, you don't do that.
Do I begin to argue with them about nothing wrong with playing cards?
No, I don't do that either. I'm going to embrace them in their fellowship because God doesn't care one way or the other what might be done.
Well, that's a study of Romans 14, hopefully giving you an overview, a general application of how that fits, in particular paying attention to the abuse and how it's been abused and how that's been misapplied in so many areas and is still being misapplied in our own day and time.
There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?